This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Alcoholics Anonymous radio show here on Plains FM 96.9. My name's Martine and I'm an alcoholic. The purpose of this show is to increase public awareness of Alcoholics Anonymous as an effective means of recovery from the disease of alcoholism. Our show has two parts. First, we talk a bit about alcoholism, what it is and what AA can do to help, and then we'll interview a recovering alcoholic who is an active member of AA. I'm now going to ask our guest to read the AA preamble, which is read at the start of every AA meeting.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thanks. So, what is alcoholism? Alcoholism is a disease, not a disgrace. There's no shame in having an illness or a disease. An unusual feature of this disease is that it will do whatever it can to convince you you don't have it. However, once it has a hold on you, the progression of the symptoms is like the classic disease model, and the victim is as helpless as a sufferer of cancer. If you're an alcoholic, you're at the beginning of a long road that usually ends in one of three places: prisons, institutions, or death. If you think that sounds dramatic, we can assure you that in our collective experience, this is shown to be true. The challenge is to convince the alcoholic to admit that they need help and become willing to seek it. Denial is a major symptom of alcoholism. The alcoholic is often the last one to recognise it and to admit that they have it. Our definition of alcoholism is that it's an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. The allergy is the physical aspect of the disease. After having the first drink, the phenomenon of craving develops and we lose control over when we will stop drinking. The old saying is, one is too many and a thousand is never enough. And yet because of the obsession of the mind, the mental aspect of the disease, the alcoholic is compelled to keep picking up the first drink. This makes us powerless. We often hear from sober alcoholics that many doubted whether life could be fun without alcohol. Those same people report that their lives have improved dramatically since they became sober. The 12-step program of recovery, which is discussed at meetings and which is outlined in the Alcoholics Anonymous Big Book, is how we get sober and maintain our sobriety one day at a time. This program has a proven track record of helping otherwise helpless alcoholics to achieve long-term sobriety and recovery. It has taught us how to enjoy life sober. Okay, for anyone who's just joined us, you're listening to the Alcoholics Anonymous radio show here on Plains FM 96.9. We're just about to interview an AA member who's going to share their experience with alcoholism. So let's meet our guest. I wonder if you'd mind giving us a bit of a sketch of who you are, you know, how old you are, how long you've been sober, your occupation, that sort of thing.
Hi, my name's Tony and I'm a recovered alcoholic. My age is coming up to 60. By the time this goes to air, I will be 60. My occupation is I'm a plastics engineer. And what else?
How long have you been sober for?
How long have I been sober? My sobriety date is the 24th of April 2009. My last drink was on the 23rd of April 2009.
Excellent. And what about your family? Are you married? Do you have children?
I've been in a relationship for 18 years now. I have a 26-year-old son from my marriage. I have, in my relationship now, I have two beautiful grandchildren. One is a 5-year-old girl, and a recent arrival is a 1-year-old boy who turns one this Monday.
Nice.
So it's her first birthday. It's going to be fun, yes.
Excellent. Could you give us a bit of your background about your childhood, where and how you grew up?
My childhood was great. I grew up on the west coast of the South Island. I'm the youngest of three boys, and I lived in a place, Greymouth, Black Bull and Reefton. And I remember having this, it's a wonderful lifestyle. We had everything you could ever want, as in the freedom. We could go eeling, trout fishing, you name it. We walked to school. There was never any fear of life. I remember first drinks and all that were over there. They were just like the mild shandy and different things like that. And I remember those. You know, they were kind of like wee fun times. But nothing really dramatic. I remember, you know, sneaking a bit of gin out of the cupboard and a bit of sherry for cooking, but nothing too major. But it was a good childhood in that sense, and that all changed in 1969 when we moved to Christchurch.
So when did you start drinking, and how did your drinking progress?
I don't want to be too intrusive upon anyone else, but in my family, alcoholism is there. I'm the son of an alcoholic, well, a recovered alcoholic who died sober.
Great.
And an older sibling who's over 30 years sober. So it's there. The disease of alcoholism is ripe in my family. And I was just a natural time bomb. I was waiting for it all to come together. It all needed to be there. And when I moved to Christchurch, it really reared its head. I went to a school because my parents tried really hard to do their best at what they could with what they could. And we moved into a state area, and I went to a school where there was those that had and those that didn't have. And I didn't have, but I had a reasonably good sort of family life. I don't even remember going cold or hungry, but yeah, I don't remember having glamour. So, and that was pointed out to me at school. So I got angry, and I had two options when I was angry. I'd swim or I'd drink, and pools were only open in the summer. So it left a bit of time for drinking.
So could you tell me about your drinking, whether you drank socially or alone or binge drinking? Just sort of what was the pattern of your drinking?
It started out, how do you say to a 14-year-old that you're drinking socially? It's very hard. And to me, I would sneak it when I could. But the thing that worked in my favour, I was a bit of a strapping lad because of the swimming and the outdoors. And there was one particular hotel in Christchurch that I could get into the bottle store. That was my target, and I started going to there and buying my own booze because I'd work jobs after school and that, and I would get my little stash. And because my family was going through a period of it where alcohol was always there, I was under the radar to a point. Yeah.
Okay. And did you ever feel it was a problem, and did you try and stop?
I knew it was a problem because Every time I had a drink, something went wrong. You talked about the phenomenon of craving. So I would have one, and I needed more, always needed more. So to counteract that, I never had one, unless I could safely get away with having more.
And what was it that made you realise that you needed help, that you needed to stop?
Well, I left school at 15. I was not invited back to the fifth form, which to me was an academic failure. I was very disappointed. I had five jobs the first year I left school. And I realised at a really young age that I did not drink like normal 15 and 16-year-olds. These guys were doing things with their lives. They were saving money. I was spending money on alcohol. And it was just that progression. It started on a Thursday and finished on a Sunday. And it just kept going like that. And then I started to learn about different things, about geographical changes, that I would lose a job and I'd go somewhere else. But you know, it's that old saying, wherever I turned up, the other Tony was always there. Hand out, ready to welcome Tony, let's get into it again. And that's how I did it.
So you lost jobs then, and what about relationships with family and friends and loved ones?
I always felt as though I never fitted in anywhere, and that's just the way it was. I didn't fit. I would look at family photos and go, I'm adopted. Something's different about it. He's got a different ear to me, and that one, you know. So I always felt, you know, maybe some distant aunt had left me with my parents, or that's just how I felt. I was always a loner, and that's the way I lived my life. Relationships with the opposite sex were very minimal because they wanted reliability and punctuality, and they didn't want you turning up at their parents' place drunk. You know, so it was relationships. No, I wasn't really bad at relationships. So that to me was the forerunner to how I treated relationships further in life. Yeah.
And what about the law? Did you get in trouble with the law?
Yes, I had some scrapes with the law. They were nothing major. I found out quite young that I was involved with a group of guys and we did something really stupid. But unfortunately, due to my age, I was incarcerated in Stanmore Boys Home for 2 weeks in solitary confinement. And I found that if I'm in there, I can't do what I want to do. And that's out here and that's to drink.
Right.
So I tethered with the law. I had a few other incidences a bit later in life, but they were all related around alcohol. So yeah, I learned at a young age.
So when you were sort of full on your addiction, full on sort of drinking, how did you feel, you know, sort of like mentally, emotionally and spiritually, how did you feel?
I didn't. I became inert, I think is the word. I lived to drink, and that was, I deemed I had no other purpose in life, and that probably one of the best things for me would be death. Because it would save a lot of people a lot of embarrassment, because I was a bit of an embarrassment, yeah.
Okay, so moving on to something a bit more positive. What about your first meeting? How was that? How did you feel? What was it like?
In regards to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, or my first involvement with getting sober?
Either.
Okay, it was, this leads from in 1990, I went out on a blind date. 6 months later, I got married. By 1992, I'm in a rehab because everything was going really badly. So I went through the Salvation Army Bridge Program, and I left there, but I didn't come to AA. By 1994, I'm a father, and I didn't have those skills. I wasn't, gifted with parental abilities, and I tried to train myself in those skills, but I did fail badly. And I switched from addiction to obsession, and I started to become obsessed in other things. Even though I was a father, and I thought I was going to be a really good father, because unfortunately my ex-wife had issues, and it wasn't her fault. I know that a lot of women have issues when a child is born, and I could never understand that at the time, but I do now. And I took up other things. I took indoor cricket, outdoor cricket, indoor netball, outdoor netball. I'd go to the gym, anything to shut the head up, because it was always crazy in there. And I'd take my son and we'd do all these things. I'd go and see my ex-mother-in-law in Nelson and tell her I'd found God, and just crazy. And it was in the year 2000 that the mental obsession, says it in the big book, that mental obsession, it was just so ripe that it got me to leave my wife and six-year-old son to go drinking again. And there's a very good friend who in the fellowship, he talks about being in Amsterdam in a fur coat in the middle of summer. Well, I ended up in New York, in New Jersey, and I sat in a bar in South Plainfields, New Jersey, and picked up the first drink. So I'd walked away from all of that to do that. And that first drink, you said it, one is too many and 1,000 is not enough. And after 9 years of absolute insanity, just craziness, on the 23rd of April, my son was living with me. We had a two-bedroom flat in Riccarton. My partner and her son were living in Hawesville. I had not gone to work for 5 days. My parents had bought meals around for my son, and I'd reached that point. It talks about the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. It's the insanity for death, and I was close to death. I knew something had to change, and it did, and I phoned AA, because that was the only thing that was available in between. Nothing else, nothing.
Yeah.
So I phoned AA, and they said, that was on the Thursday, and they said, the meeting is on, there's one tonight. I said, I'm not up to that, but there's one on Friday.
So I was just going to say, can you tell us about that meeting on the
first
Friday?
Meeting, sat down, and everyone was talking about me. Mass paranoia. Someone's phoned them and let them know that I'm coming. So sharing me. And yeah, but as soon as I sat down, I related and I went, you know, you fool, this is where you should have come when you left the bridge. Because this is your people, they're here. Every one of these people in this room, even though they might drive a BMW or they might ride a bike, they're you. They're exactly like you. They're no different.
So how do you think you've managed to stay sober? Can you describe the process of recovery or what's worked for you?
Like the first year was smoking, drinking a lot of black coffee, white knuckling. Yeah, well, one of the things was I knew if I went back, I'd die.
Right.
and that was it, death. I had no other option. I would lose my job, my partner would leave me, my parents would have nothing to do with me, and my son would be taken away from me. And I knew that, and they were the driving forces, until I got enough time up to start to work the program. And that was to redo the 12 steps of the program, because nothing else in my life had worked, but those 12 steps that are up on the wall, I was told, take them off the wall and put them into your life. And the first step is the one that you need to figure out. And I figured it out real quick.
Right.
I'm powerless over alcohol because when I drink it, my life becomes truly unmanageable.
So how do you cope when you've got difficulties in your life?
How do I cope? Well, I'm really, really lucky. My partner's been very understanding. My parents were really good to me. Even though I'd been so abusive and such an idiot and a fool and treated them badly and embarrassed them, really, that they stuck with me and I just had to keep going to meetings, no matter how painful they were sometimes, how some people might annoy me, but I probably annoyed them as well.
So when you've got, if you've got difficulties in your life, what sort of mechanisms do you use to cope with them? Meetings and sponsors and things like that, what do you use?
I quite often look at my hand basin. Because that holds a great deal of meaning to me. Because that was part of my end of my drinking, was that I was urinating in a hand basin. So if I ever think that I've got my life's rubbish, I'll just go and look at a hand basin. And then it's really, life's pretty good actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're some of my coping mechanisms. But I have a really good sponsor, which is, I've had the same sponsor, I've never changed sponsor. And if you're new to this program and you don't understand what a sponsor is, they don't pay you to do anything. They're there to help you go through the steps, and when times get tough, you get in touch with them. And the ironic thing about my sponsor is he's a school teacher, and I hated them. I hate them with passion. But, it's just the way that, the hand is dealt to you, and take the most of it. Dealing with my parents, dealing with my son, they are coping mechanisms for me. But there's other things in my life which I can't really go deeply into, that I had to let go of because holding on is killing me. Even halfway through this journey, there were some events in my life that I was so ashamed of, that the most trusted person that you have in the fellowship is your sponsor, that I could not sit down and tell them about. But they were still keeping me sick. There's the physical, that allergy we talk about, that's the physical sickness. There's the mental sickness as well that just keeps tapping away in your brain. So I eventually found out I was an Anglican, and I found an Anglican priest, and I sat down with this priest and I told him exactly what had happened, and it was just this great relief, and another handbrake was released from my journey, and I just carried on a bit more.
Cool. So how would you describe yourself and your life today?
Oh, it's just in the book. It's a life beyond the wildest dreams. I never imagined I could have what I have today. And it's not a lot, as you and I were sharing before we came in.
Yeah.
It was, just simple things in life. It says in the big book where it talks about grandiose. We're super sensitive, grandiose and childish. All those things have gone. I have a car that takes me to work. I have a job that pays me reasonably good money. My son talks to me. My parents talk to me. One of the, I suppose, the greatest gifts of this fellowship was when my father passed away. And he'd suffered badly in his day's end. And to be there holding his hand when he passed, to me, is what this program's about.
Yeah.
I couldn't have done that while I was still drinking. I wouldn't have been alive. I know I wouldn't have been alive if I was carried on the path I was, because in 2014, I underwent open-heart surgery to replace a valve and a leaflet in my heart, which I was born with a defect no one ever knew. But due to the amount of rubbish I'd chucked into my body, I had a heart disease as well. So I was a ticking time bomb. They said I probably would have maybe 6 months max.
So AA is described as a spiritual program. What does the spiritual side or spirituality mean to you?
Right and wrong. If I'm going to do something wrong, that's not spiritual. If I'm out to, sabotage anyone, that's wrong. It's just being able to sit down after a day's work, sit down at home, put feet up, have a nice cup of Jed's grade 4 coffee, and it's done. Cook my partner tea, go around and see my mum. Every second Friday I take a grocery shopping now that Dad's not there. Just things like that. It's that ultimate ease. You know, they talk about radio stations in your head, and there's an old timer, he's from a place called Dingo in Australia, and he always talks about this knot in his stomach. You know, it was always so tight, and I don't have that anymore. That knot is gone. One of the great things about this fellowship is I know what's right and I know what's wrong.
Yeah.
If I want the knot, I'll do wrong. So I just, there's laws, there's everything that are laid down that I follow. I try not to deviate.
Right. And what would you suggest for any listeners who, they may be listening to the radio show, they may be admitting to themselves they've got a drinking problem. What advice do you give to them? What are you going to say? What do you think they should do?
Well, if you're listening to what I've just shared, if you think you've got a drinking problem, there's an old saying, I remember thought you plant a feather and grow a hen. So you need to, that's a thought in your head that you might have a drinking problem, phone AA. They will have a chat with you. They'll send someone around to talk to you about it. They'll share their experience, strength and hope. Yeah. Well, there is another thing they talk about in the fellowship is, it's in the big book, so I can quote it. Go out and try and do a bit of controlled drinking. Say I'm only going to have two drinks tonight. See how well that works. Yeah.
Tony, thanks very much for coming in.
It's been a privilege.
And thanks for sharing your story with us. For our listeners, if you've related to anything you've heard or would like more information about Alcoholics Anonymous, you can look us up on the web at www.aa.org.nz or call us on 0800 AA Works. There are over 60 meetings a week in Canterbury, so it's likely there's one near you. Join us next week to hear from more AAs sharing their experience. Our show is every Monday at 5:30 on Plains FM and repeats on Wednesday at 12:30. You can also find podcasts of our past shows on the Plains FM website at plainsfm.org.nz, or you can download, subscribe and listen to podcasts on iTunes and Spotify. Well, that brings us to the end of the show. Thank you for listening. And remember, if you want to drink, that's your business. If you want to stop, we can help. You don't have to do it alone. We will now close with a serenity prayer, as we do in every AA meeting.
God
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can,
and the wisdom to know the difference.
You've been listening to the Alcoholics Anonymous radio show on Plains FM 96.9.